to ready for battle in every shape, way, or form. And I could go into action with her in a matter of hours of notice. And this is something that I want to keep repeating about our ships. They are all ready for battle in a matter of hours. They carry their wartime complement of they may be slightly short of men for manning all weapons, but they were very much on a war footing, even in those days, 1947.
Well, it says here, in July 47, you were named commanding officer of the cruiser Ontario.
That's right.
And you're going to keep this command for 2 years. And as commander of Ontario, you felt you had to, get the ship up to muster? Is that the...
Ontario had a complement of about 100,000 men, just under. And I had at that time, four destroyers or three destroyers and a frigate on it.
So you'd be what, senior Canadian officer afloat?
I'd be senior Canadian officer afloat.
Pacific.
And I took her down to the West Indies twice to exercise with the Commander-in-Chief, American West Indies Squadron. But what I want to make point clear, and someday it's just going to have to come out more fully, and that is that I became very interested in exercising with the American forces. You should be somebody bigger than yourself, working with somebody bigger than yourself. You should be just like playing bridge or tennis. You want somebody better than yourself. And everywhere I went, I worked in with the Americans and asked them if I could join with them in forces. Now, I'm going to take 2 minutes on this with them. There's no NATO. In those days, even NATO, when he was signed in 1949, NATO was signed in 49. But there's no political agreement. There'd be never NATO in the Pacific. No political agreement. There's no political agreement to work with the other forces. And we were so soon after the war, and it was considered. Canada was very anxious to keep out of any entanglements and didn't want to get accused of preparing for a war against the Russians. And we were back to the good old days of
there was another thing there as well. We have Pearson. Well, he doesn't really come on the scene yet, but a new desire to show the flag and this type of thing, isn't there, sir?
Oh yes, we were pinched for money. For cruises, we weren't pitched for money. For ammunition, we weren't pitched for money. For exercises, we were really in 1947 to 49. I had a wonderful command, a senior officer afloat with four running destroyers, and I worked between the CNC Pacific down to Panama through the American West Indies Squadron. And later on, we joined out and went joined forces and went to the South Pacific with these people. And this is what made me. I must tell you about this, because it's a very interesting thing. I had to arrange exercises with the U.S. fleet, be it at San Diego, to Panama, and I would have not be able to tell Ottawa about it. I think they wouldn't mind my doing it. I don't think I wasn't being disloyal to my country. I just knew that they would, somebody would question why you were exercising with the American fleet preparing for what might be a future conflict. We had no political arrangement between our respective countries for united effort. Is that clear to you?
Yes, it is, sir.
And this is something that was very much in my mind. And later on, it was so valuable to me because from here I went to the National War College in Washington and came back with a very clear position, and you'll be asking me about Flag Officer Pacific Coast later, but I came back here, and the first short time I got in an airplane, went out to see CNC Pacific, who has a huge force, his command runs right out to India and North Pole and South Pole, it's a tremendous command, and I flew out to him, and I looked at my own area here of command and saw my responsibilities and saw my task forces, and I worked. He put a very fine officer on my staff, And we worked out a plan here. It was called the Stump-Hibbert Agreement. And we didn't know what to call it. We signed an agreement between us. It was very little alteration was made by the American government. Not one word was altered by the Canadian government. And Mr. Claxton, who was still minister when I was there, came to me and said, Jimmy Hibbert, I can't take this to cabinet. What about Canada's sovereignty? And I said, Mr. Minister, if we don't do this, there's a vacuum here. And somebody's going to have to do it for you, and then your sovereignty is going to be in trouble. I said, if we do it now, of our own free will...
Yeah, at least you have a say. Yeah.
And we have a say, and we got through, and this is now called the Alaska-Canadian-U.S. Defense Plan. But this turned into... this was the military rather pushing the government a little bit. They get worried when they think they've been pushed. we've got something here that is... we wrote it as a war agreement. We put small print where nobody noticed. It'll be exercised in peace, you see. And we got away with it that way. And we had a wonderful... Our force tabs today, I could go out with the American fleet and transfer tactical command at sea just like that with one signal. And work with all my ships in this.
Now you're on the Ontario down in Panama showing the flag, and you had mentioned before difficulties with you got yourself into a diplomatic sort of a situation. I was wondering if you could go into
that. Well, those are things that happen all over the world. You go into... I remember Greenway was our minister down there, the British minister down there, and we have no Canadian minister, we have a British minister. Mm-hmm. And I found myself in the canal zone. Now, you understand between Panama and the canal zone. I'd sent ahead some blank invitations to have a reception in the Ontario by the commanding officer and officers of the Ontario. And to my unbelievable surprise, he'd asked the whole of the Panamanian government to my ship.
Who's this?
Greenway, who was the minister, British minister. We had no Canadian minister in Panama. And he'd asked the whole of the Panamanian government down to the ship, and I was found myself in a very awkward position because they were hardly talking to each other. The armed forces in the military, General Ridgway was commander in chief Caribbean at the time, and I found myself in a frightful position where the Panamanian government was coming through to American territory to all visit this ship when they hadn't been invited by the American government for about 5 years. So I went straight to General Ridgway and I said, look, General, I'm in trouble. I need your help. And I told my band to learn how to play the Panamanian national anthem. And he said, we'll see this thing through. And I received the Panamanian government with General Ridgway, and I put the minister in the back of the ship somewhere, and I didn't pay any attention to him, old party. He and my wife was staying with him at the time, too. But I had to... This is one of these things you have to do. You don't wire your government. That's a great thing. We'd never had a navy if we'd had wireless, you know, or radio.
Wiring the navy government for instruction.
Yes, yes.
Oh dear.
We wouldn't have.
General Ridgway.
He backed me to the hill.
Of
course, we talked the same language. We backed this. We knew a minister was a minister, and he was trying to make headway. But we did this, and we had exercises with Sir William Tennant, who went down in the Prince of Wales, Prince of Wales and
the Repulse or the Renown?
One of those two.
Yeah.
He was captain of that when she sank in Singapore. And a nice man. And he, all these exercises, my ships, I got permission. We went into Guantanamo and in Cuba. We exercised with the American forces there. And we had tremendous exercises right from Honolulu, Hawaii, South Pacific, American West India Squadron. And
who was back here looking after the fort?
Well, we had an admiral commanding here.
No, but I meant ship-wise.
Well, we had nearly all the ships with us, you know, all the ones that mattered, all the fighting ships. And so I had 2 years, tremendous years in that ship. Wonderful exercises, and it was background too for when later on when I took over flag officer on the coast, maritime commander out here. I look back on this, and that's when I went ahead with the plans for the...
With your close cooperation with the captain of Ontario.
Yeah.
Now, your tenure on Ontario was very pleasing, I guess.
Well, delightful.
And it came to an end very quickly, I would assume.
Well, it came to an end when not very quickly. It came to the end. I couldn't have asked for a longer day. I had 2 years and 2 months, I guess. I had my full whack there, and to my great pleasure and thrill and happiness, I was appointed to the National War College in Washington, which is about the highest level college you can go anywhere I know of. It's a wonderful course. It's a wonderful year.
To the Imperial Army College, I guess.
Or yes, IDC. It's the same as it's this opposite number. The Americans do it wonderfully. I'm going back to visit them this spring, and I'm in touch with them. And in fact, one of my class phoned me just the other day in Victoria. We have a it's a wonderful time to make friendships. We're all between 40 and 50 years old, and you go there with one question and one problem, and that is, you're given one question on arrival, and you work on it the whole time you're there. What are your national objectives? What policies should you pursue to achieve them? What are our national objectives? What policy should you pursue to achieve?
Well, I'm going to give that to a Canadian officer because Canada doesn't have national objectives.
We don't have any policies.
Well, that's like defining Johnny McDonald's national dream, right? Sometimes it's impossible.
I never thought of it that way. Yeah, I should have told him. I told him that I was still looking at my letters here from them the other day. They're just wonderful people, and I was reading my report from that college only yesterday when I was going through these papers getting ready for your visit, and I remember this fellow General Bull. Just a wonderful year. Just a wonderful year. Yes, they write to you, you contribute much to the course by freely giving the college of your associates the benefits of your views and your personal experience. All of us are thoroughly enjoyed and profited by your fine participation. And then he goes on to write, you know, this is a wonderful year. Then he ends up, these are good things for us to go to these courses too. I add my own best wishes to those of your classmates, the resident faculty, the entire staff, for your continued professional success. We have great confidence therein. We hope that you have enjoyed being with us, as we have appreciated the pleasure and privilege of serving with you and knowing you. We feel that in you we have found a real lasting friend and believe the mutual benefits resulting from your participation in the National War College course and the friendships you have made here will stand our respective countries in good stead in the future. Mm-hmm. These are things that are so important. It stood me in an unbelievable position when I went back there again. When you read my report of proceedings going to Korea, mm-hmm. you'll find the people that I was dealing with there were mm-hmm. classmates of mine here.
The old network, I guess. Thank
yes, it, it's a wonderful time, dude. It's a wonderful... you have participated in all phases of the academic work undertaken at this college and have entered wholeheartedly into all the discussions and all the activities. It's a great year, you know. You have a tremendous, tremendous year in a course like this. What are your national objectives? I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, well, we have none. But I couldn't say that when I got down there, could I?
Now, you would spend, what, a year or 2 years?
Yeah, 1 year.
1 year, and that was your task.
Yeah.
And you would work, what, an 8-hour day?
You'd work an 18-hour day.
18?
Yep. You'd be at your desk at 8 in the morning. And I lived half an hour away over that. We'd come down by carpool for Rock Creek Drive. And you'd go down there, and you'd expect to read the New York Times and a few of these papers, you know, they're only papers about 4 inches thick down there. But you learned how to read a newspaper. I thought you've all been to university, watched how to read on things. I didn't learn. See, I was very late at being told these things and taught. So important. You only read, you know, you never read what some individual, some bloke has to say. You don't read Dorothy Dix or Dear Abby. You read what is the Minister of Defense of England had said, the Prime Minister had said, you could skim a paper through and take away 99% of a paper is just washed out anyway. And they taught you how to to get the meat out of these papers. So before our first lecture at 8:30 in the morning, we had skimmed through these papers and were able to discuss anything that came up. The tops of the world came. We had the president, we had Churchill, we had the tops of the world. Whenever they dealt with a country, they flew back their ambassador to sit with us while we were dealing with that country. We dealt with country by country. They flew us all over the world. We flew us to different parts of to different parts. You see, one group would go to. I did my thesis, 10,000 word on Germany, the Ruhr Charter. I don't know whether you've heard of the Ruhr Charter or not, and establishing Germany after the war. Most of our work was political in nature. We had about 40% were military, Central Intelligence, Budget, Treasury, State Department, Foreign State Department Service. These are the groups we had with us. And
how many Canadians were there?
Two. And
just you and who else?
Montsell, Bob Montsell. And we had a time of our wonderful, wonderful year. It was just. I said the tops of the world would come. You'd have, I'm thinking of Dr. Mead, an anthropologist, would come in one day, or even Mrs. Roosevelt would come another day. Evening lectures would be these people quite often. You'd have, I could give you all sorts of names. The tops of Americans would be there. And they all had something very interesting to say on this. It was a tremendous year of doing it. How about, if I give anything more today, I'll give you my speech and then give you a speech. From the National War College, you want to go to Chief of Naval Personnel and then the Flag Officer. We have to do that another session, I think.
I think we should leave it till the next session, sir, and then we can start afresh again.
Right.
We've got an awful lot covered today. And thank you very much for making the time. Because, we got two sides of the tape.
Have we finished that tape yet?
Well, just about. The first side of it.
I would say that the National War College has stood me in great stead. It's made... I'd never had to produce a 10,000-word thesis before, and things of this nature. That's why
I guess, making you sharpen your mind with it.
Not only that, but... the people you rub shoulders with are just tops. Four of them became head of the service in the United States. Four of them became, two became chairman of the Joint Chiefs down there. Ambassadors, every one of my class who was on the State Department became an ambassador.
Yeah.
And these are all of a level that...
I wasn't laying around the grass at the
University
of Victoria discussing life.
It was all just fascinating sort of thing.
And that would be your primary staff work, college work.
You have that past. Yep.
I find it interesting, sir. I'm not trying to be.
I'm making your point well.
Jerk or anything, but a lot of senior officers, whether in the Canadian Forces, whether it be the Navy, the Air Force, whatever it is. Usually get this staff college work, and it would be a real plum to go to
yeah.
this war defense college, or this
yeah.
American war college, national war
oh,
college.
Oh boy, that was a great one, yeah.
Now, I find
you're not allowed to apply for that.
No, you would be
you have to be.
And what I don't understand is why...
Oh, I got there.
because the competition for that would be as great could be, but without the prerequisite, if you will, of the staff college training in Canada. And I find that most intriguing.
I find it intriguing, too. I don't know how I competed, because a lot of these fellows, had PhDs before they got there.
Yeah. Well, no, this is what I'm getting at. You see, because you take, as I say, if a person has, the work requires training of a thesis and all these things, well, 90% of the time, most of the officers have been taught that at a Canadian staff college or a British staff college, so that when they went to foreign country war colleges, they would have the academic skill, if you will, to do it. And I think that's what speaks highly of you to jump that step. But I think you jumped quite a few steps along the way.
Well, when they don't know what to do with you, they kick you up the ladder, I was laughing the other day. I was laughing at my friends at the party the other night. They're saying that, you see, two things happened to me in 1 month here. The way they kicked you out, I've been vice president of the Cancer Foundation, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So the way they got me out of that was make me honorary vice president. And I've been on the board of governors of the commissionaires for 18 years, so they made me an honorary one. So it's a good way of kicking you out, isn't it?
Oh, that's wonderful. Admiral Hibbard, thank you very much. I think we got an awful lot done today. And thanks very much for making the time. I appreciate it.
Good. Nice talking to you, Chris. You're a good fellow to talk to.